This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm David Kestenbaum, in for Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about a plan to send a probe to the center of the Earth. It's just a plan at this point. And a national terrorism drill that's finishing up today. The drill includes a fake outbreak of plague in Chicago. Meanwhile, the very real outbreak of SARS is continuing. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is in Beijing. He joins us now for an update. Hi, Richard.
Hello, David.
There are 39 new cases of SARS in China today. Most of them, I think, where you are in Beijing. For more than a week, the cases have been going down and down. Is the disease under control there?
Well, the Beijing government and the Chinese government would like to say yes, but the World Health Organization says not so fast. It is likely to be months before this thing is under control. And even though it's been a very hopeful trend for the last week or so, this is a disease that doesn't follow a nice tidy curve of rising and falling. There are likely to be spikes and there are likely to be other outbreaks and so on. So the World Health Organization says there's still just not enough data to say that this really reflects a trend, although, of course, everyone here is happy and you can see people breathing a little bit more freely on the streets and acting as though the worst is over, whether or not it is.
Are people still wearing masks?
Yeah, I would say about 10% of people are wearing masks. They are most of the waitresses and so on continue to wear masks, probably more for the comfort of their guests than anything else. But on the street, I would say most everybody has shed them by now.
Have you been wearing yours? I remember NPR sent you over with quite a number, I think.
I have not had an opportunity to wear a mask. I went over to a compound today where there was a case that had been fairly recently diagnosed, and the person I was traveling with said, "Shouldn't we wear a mask?" And I said, "Well, my rule is if the doctors in the room are wearing masks, I will wear a mask. If the doctors aren't, I won't." And the doctors weren't wearing masks, so I left it at that.
There's a lot of concern about the rural areas. How is the WHO going to be convinced they can believe the numbers that are coming out of there?
Well, I think the WHO knows that the numbers only tell part of the story because nobody can be absolutely sure that the numbers are correct. They seem to be fairly low right now, just about 100 cases all told from rural areas in China out of a total number of about almost 5,200 cases. So it's a small proportion of the total cases. But realistically, the rural health authorities are not going to be as efficient at reporting things. They may have incentives not to report things. They have serious incentives also to report things because they can get in trouble for not being honest. They can get in trouble for having SARS. So it's sort of a no-win situation for the rural health folks. So the answer is people won't necessarily have full faith in those numbers. But the one thing about SARS is it won't hide forever. So if cases are going unreported, eventually the truth will out because the disease will spread again and the numbers will rise. So the answer is it's a really tough problem. It's one of the hardest problems here for people who are trying to figure out how to get this epidemic under control.
And are you being allowed to travel to those areas? Can people leave the cities and go out to the rural areas?
People can leave the cities, but it is uncertain what happens to them when they get to their destinations. A lot of farmers who are decided to leave the farm and become migrant workers have discovered when they've returned to their farming villages that the villages often lock them up and for a week or 10 days or 20 days or somewhat of a specified period of time because nobody wants to see this disease erupt in villages. And so they're being as cautious as they can. There are lots of stories of villages that simply pile up bricks or dirt across the road leading into their villages. So people can't go by, or people can't go in. They can go by, but they can't go in. And the Chinese government is trying to balance this desire to have a slowdown in the spread of people and possibly disease. They like that part of it, but they also are concerned that commerce not be too interrupted because China really is concerned about making its economy grow as quickly as possible. So their rules say, you know, stop people from coming in, but don't stop commerce. And I'm not sure exactly how that's working out on the ground, but that's what the Chinese government is trying to have happen here.
Right. Do you think there's any way in which it's easier for a government like China, you know, where there are so many controls on what people can do? I mean, families are limited to having basically one child. Do you think it makes it at all in some way easier for them to be able to clamp down and control something like SARS?
I definitely think it does, and I think that's why some of the World Health organization officials seem to express pretty good confidence that eventually this disease will be brought under control, possibly even eradicated in China. China is doing things that would create an outcry, I think, to some degree in the United States, locking people up or essentially having neighbors report on other neighbors and really some fairly significant measures, which from the standpoint of disease control are probably strong medicine for a disease that's really a very dangerous disease and not easy to control once it gets into rural places in particular. But it's also these are measures that would raise eyebrows and would probably in many cases not happen in the United States.
There are some pretty harsh penalties now, I understand, for intentionally spreading SARS.
That's right. The official news agency quoted the Supreme Court of China today, reminding people that there's a law that says that you could actually be executed for an egregious enough penalty of spreading a disease deliberately or some such thing. There are there's at least one report of somebody who had been arrested for breaking quarantine. There are more than 100 people have been arrested for us just spreading rumors. One thing the Chinese government wants to control is information as well as the disease. And a lot of these cell phones that have little text messaging were used to create a great burst of messages, some true, some apparently not true. And the government was trying to crack down on rumors. And so that's another way that they're trying to, keep a handle on the situation here.
Right. What do you think the prospects look like for eradication? I mean, does it look like this is going to be something we'll be hearing about every year, or something that maybe possibly they can actually eliminate?
Well, the possibility is they can eliminate it. I think the consequences of having covered it up at the beginning are that it has spread a lot more than it would have spread if they had just been open and honest at the beginning and tried to identify everyone who had it at that time, and they would have had a much better chance of just being able to snuff it out at the beginning. There was essentially one generation or two generations of people or more with this disease who went through undetected. Their contacts were never followed up, and so as a result, there were many, many people spreading the disease, and it is now getting to be a much, much bigger job to track down the source of every new disease. In fact, most of the time in Beijing, they are not able to figure out exactly who spread the disease to whom. When a new case comes up, half the time they say, we don't know where it came from. And presumably it just came from one of these uncounted people earlier on. But that makes it a very, very big challenge. On the other hand, China is at the highest levels politically and societally has mobilized around this disease, and they've just made it absolutely the national priority here. So I think it's hard to imagine any country being able to do a better job, considering what the circumstances right now are, than China can, considering its laws and its national will.
Okay. Thanks very much, Richard.
My pleasure, David.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. This week, disaster struck closer to home, or at least it seemed to. A dirty bomb exploded in Chicago, and plague was released in a dirty bomb was in Seattle. The plague was in Chicago. In each city, the events unfolded like a highly scripted action movie, because, in fact, they were scripted, part of the largest ever terror drill headed up by the Department of Homeland Security. In Chicago, the story went something like this. Last weekend, a fictitious terror group released fake clouds of plague at Union Station, also O'Hare Airport, and the United Center Sports Stadium. By Tuesday, volunteer patients began showing up at hospitals with flu-like symptoms, and by midweek, hospitals were overwhelmed by scores of people seeking treatment and antibiotics. On top of it all, Thursday's events included a mock plane crash and a simulated release from a chemical plant designed to further tax the city and the state's emergency response systems. The Chicago and Seattle drills were set up to test how well local, state, and federal officials would respond to a terrorist attack. This hour, we'll talk about just how realistic these events were and how much emergency responders can really learn from a drill that's anything but a surprise. So if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we're talking about, you can check out our website. It's www.sciencefriday.com. There are links to our topic there. Now let me introduce the guests. John McCormick is a general assignment reporter at the Chicago Tribune. He's been covering this week's bioterror drill, and he joins us by phone from Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Bernard Turnock is a clinical professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the director of the Illinois Public Health Preparedness Center, also at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He joins us today by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Pleasure to be with you.
John, you've been covering the drill for the Tribune. Tell us what happened this week in and around Chicago.
Well, as you characterized it, there was a very, very scripted series of events that started actually on Saturday with this theoretical release of pneumonic plague at the three public venues that you mentioned. Patients started showing up, first paper patients. They would fax information to the hospitals detailing, certain scenarios of symptoms that people might be presenting. They also put in some kind of red herring patients, people who maybe were presenting other symptoms, maybe in terms of SARS, or even there were some patients who were faxed in who were actually presenting symptoms of being alcoholics. And so they gradually diagnosed this thing according to the script that it was an outbreak of pneumonic plague. And the real patients who were wearing yellow T-shirts started showing up at hospitals around the area on Tuesday. Some hospitals got busloads of them. Other hospitals just got a few. And as you mentioned, much of this drill was telegraphed in advance, which has been criticized by some. And one of the things that was telegraphed was the hospitals were allowed to decide how many patients they wanted to show up, in essence. Some hospitals wanted 50 patients, others just wanted a few. And then the whole event kind of climaxed yesterday. The drill technically is not over for about another 40 minutes, I guess. It wraps up at about 2 o'clock Central Time. But the drama yesterday was at its peak, where patients were still showing up at hospitals. They had set up treatment centers around the metropolitan area to provide antibiotics. There were a mock plane crash at Midway Airport. There was a building collapse on the city's kind of southwest side, and all this bedlam to test how the emergency responders could react to all this.
Did it actually disrupt things in Chicago at all?
Not very much. We actually expected that it was going to be more of a traffic bottleneck than it turned out to be. They closed down a road near Midway Airport yesterday for several hours, but just checking with traffic reporters and so forth, there weren't any major problems. There was speculation during the week that there was going to be a huge motorcade down the Kennedy Expressway bringing these antibiotics from O'Hare to the downtown area. And even when the president comes to town and shuts down the Kennedy, it's a pretty big deal and not very popular. But that didn't really play out either. There were a small number of vehicles who traveled on the Kennedy, but it really looked like they did everything they could to minimize the disruption to the public.
From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm David Kestenbaum in for Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about this week's large-scale mock bioterror attack in Chicago. My guests are Dr. Bernard Turnock, clinical professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the director of the Illinois Public Health Preparedness Center, and John McCormick, who's a general assignment reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Dr. Turnock, maybe you can talk a little bit about what would happen in a real situation when people start to show up at a hospital with flu-like symptoms.
Well, the medical and the public health system has been working for several years now. In fact, several years before the anthrax events of 2001, to upgrade their capabilities to recognize and act upon communicable diseases that are the result of some sort of bioterrorism event. So there's a heightened level of awareness and training among frontline physicians and emergency physicians and nurses, and especially those in emergency departments, to be able to recognize diseases that are more likely to be the results of some sort of bioterrorism event, and to promptly report those kinds of incidents to the health department as well as to law enforcement authorities to trigger the kind of coordinated response that we saw with the top off 2 exercise.
I mean, in the winter, it's got to be tough. There are a lot of people with flu.
Well, obviously, there's lots of people with flu, but there's substantial medical capability to determine what illnesses are more likely to be related to the kinds of microorganisms that a bioterrorist might use, and to alert authorities to that effect. So there is a whole new science developing in terms of recognizing symptoms and attributing symptoms to specific diseases and evaluating those diseases for their likelihood of being a bioterrorist event.
I mean, how would you recognize plague, for instance?
Well, plague will present just almost like any other kind of upper respiratory infection, but a physician or an emergency department would take clinical samples that would be rapidly evaluated, and within a few hours one could have a presumptive diagnosis of plague if one had a high degree of suspicion. Plague is a disease that does occur throughout the country and throughout the world, and so an isolated case wouldn't necessarily mean that it was a result of some sort of bioterrorist effort. But if several cases at the same hospital or cases in neighboring hospitals were identified at about the same time, one could very quickly come to the conclusion that there could possibly be that kind of event going on under the surface.
Okay, let's go to one of our lines here. JR from Columbus, you're on the line.
Hi, I'm an emergency management director in Columbus, Ohio, and wanted to talk a little bit about the benefits of this type of exercise. Even though it may be scripted, there are a couple of things that are very good to come out of this. One is, if you know what you're looking for during the exercise, you tend to train to those types of symptoms you might be seeing, or knowing how to respond to that, which is a good thing, because then if when a situation develops along these lines, you already have a very good idea of how to respond. The second is that any kind of exercise fosters a closer working relationship with all the participants, and in this case it's a fairly wide scale, lots of participants from different agencies that may not work together on a day-to-day basis. So by having the opportunity to work together beforehand, it helps them respond to an incident when it does take place, and no matter what kind it is, whether it's terrorism or a tornado.
Okay. John McCormick, I mean, how realistic did this look to you? Did people look like they were actually, you know, feeling like they were in an emergency situation, or they just looked like they were going through the motions?
Well, it kind of depended on the actor. Some of them were pretty good actors, some of them weren't. But, I mean, at the hospitals, they were wearing special T-shirts that said that they were, you know, right. Participants in the drill, so as not to alarm other patients.
And what about the people responding to it, I guess? You know, do the people at the hospital, was there some urgency there, or were they just, you know, feeling like they were going through a game, sort of?
Well, I think they felt like there was some urgency. I was at a treatment center yesterday, kind of on the north side of Chicago, where they were administering antibiotics to people. And, I mean, they did look like they were trying to move people through the lines as quickly as they could. But in terms of, you know, how real this felt, it really didn't feel very real at all. The one place maybe where it was a little bit more real was they were dealing with a building collapse yesterday, kind of trying to simulate, you know, what the World Trade Center building looked like at a much smaller scale, and how you would dig people out of the rubble, and there things fell apart a little bit yesterday. Some of the fire chiefs said that, you know, that the participants were being too cautious. They wanted to stick to the rules of the drill, and therefore they weren't doing instinctively what they should be doing. So I think there was a little bit of, you know, throughout the week, let's just make sure that we stay within the rules and don't make any big mistakes.
Okay. JR, thanks for your call.
David, could I respond to that, too?
Sure.
Because I think the caller made a very good point here, that sometimes these exercises really are not so useful for testing the date, you know, the specific activity of a nurse or a physician or a firefighter, you know, going through the rubble and all. But what it really tests are some of the higher level activities that take place in terms of these responses, in terms of command and control, who's in charge, who's making decisions, how is information communicated, how are the many, many different federal, state, and local agencies coordinated in a timely fashion, so that the things that are written down in the plans that are supposed to happen not only happen, but they happen in a timely fashion. And so these exercises may look like walkthroughs at the ground level, where patients migrants are coming in or where buildings are falling down or where planes are crashing, but there's a whole complex set of communications and decision-making that's on top of that, and that's a big part of what's being tested here and really why they call this top-off, you know, top officials, getting them personally involved in processes that they may be relatively unfamiliar or uncomfortable with.
Okay. Let's take another call. Leslie from Philadelphia, you're on the line.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. I'm old enough to remember the whole concept of getting under your desk when the nuclear bombs were to hit. So I do understand these kinds of preparations from a historical perspective. And I think the practice is excellent. But I'm wondering whether maybe we ought to also consider that even rather than anthrax or SARS or the plague, perhaps it's something more subtle. Are we taking into consideration, for instance, in laboratories, for instance, the makers of flu shots for people, what kind of intelligence do we have on the infiltration of the preparation of medications? Because in my estimation, the next attack, because the others have been a feel-out, will probably be something a little more subtle.
Okay, Dr. Turnock, you want to...
is good in emergencies.
Thanks. Dr. Turnock, you want to talk about how are we preparing for too narrow a scenario? Are we locked into this idea of dirty bomb and plague at these obvious locations?
Well, I really don't think so. I think an awful lot of the effort that's been generated since 2001 has focused on building stronger emergency response plans and systems that would respond to all kinds of threats and hazards, not just terrorism, including natural disasters and mass casualties and all kinds of situations that require coordinated planning across agencies, and so I think it's impossible to predict exactly what the next kind of event will be in terms of terrorism or even specifically in terms of bioterrorism. But the mechanisms are in place to get the forces together to deal through each and every one of those in a coordinated fashion.
Okay, let me remind everyone, if you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-989-TALK. John McCormick, I was reading also that that a lot of information is not actually being made available to the media. That that there won't be a full report card and things like that. Is there a lot of things you've been kept out of?
Yeah, and the access to the actual behind the scenes stuff there just was none. They really kind of kept the media away. Just we could film things and kind of observe the real public outward things, but being in the conference rooms where the decisions were being made, obviously they didn't allow us in there, and that's the most important place. So Tom Ridge was in town yesterday and held a press conference that, Chicago had done reasonably well and, had a lot of curveballs thrown at it and had weathered the storm pretty well. But the real kind of detail of this likely won't be released until sometime this fall when there is expected to be a report that kind of highlights things. They say they don't want, that information public because they don't want terrorists to be able to take advantage of where the holes are, and I think everyone can kind of appreciate that. But it did make it challenging to... try to get your hands around this in terms of just how well or how poorly it's going. We picked up small little things along the way of where there were glitches, people who said they didn't have enough pens or staplers or the two-way radios weren't working quite correctly.
I'm glad the terrorists don't know that.
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Turnock, is that... is that you think the real reasons are also a bit of, well, we don't want to, the city has volunteered graciously to do this and run through this. We don't want to, embarrass them if we find bad things. Let's just fix the problem.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think we have to remember that we're still pretty early in in the use of the massive funds that have been devoted to terrorism and bioterrorism, and really we've only had about a year to put those kinds of resources to work, and now we're really just beginning to test those systems that have developed so that we can find where the larger glitches and the problems and gaps are, and then incrementally improve our response capability. So I think the city and the state are as eager to find out what the problems were and to enhance the systems that have been developed as the media is.
Okay, let's take another call. Doug from San Antonio, you're on the line. What's your question?
Yeah, Yeah, 20 years ago I was working for the government at a naval shipyard. I was with the Radiation Control Division. And our primary role was to repair and overhaul nuclear-powered submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And every 6 months, we would have a major drill of an accident aboard the ship. And I'm talking an accident of a reactor accident, the release of radioactive material to the environment, all kinds of problems aboard the ship itself. And it got to a point, I was there for 10 years, and it got to a point we knew every 6 months we're going to have the drill. Matter of fact, the whole yard knew we were having the drill.
Did you know the actual day of it?
We knew what time it would start. We knew what time it would end.
Ah.
And yeah, it got to a point.
That's the military,
you know,
punctual.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't stop production either.
Right.
And I kind of got to a point, are we really serving a purpose here? Because we're running through the same paces, and we never failed. Because if we failed, then there was a matter of, we can't do the work, so we'd have to be shut down.
Right. So what do you make of this?
That's what I'm wondering. You know, I mean, did we, is this thing doing any good? I mean, they knew the day it was going to start. They knew the cities they were going to be in. They knew when it's going to end. And as one of your speakers said earlier, hey, this is for the top-end guys to make sure that they know how to cooperate and get things done among themselves. But the people that are down on the deck plates and the people that are down getting exposed and the people down digging in the rubble are the ones that are directly involved and affected on some of these things, and I think maybe they kind of get left out.
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
That's a great question. Thank you very much, Dr. Turnock. You wanna speak to that?
Well, I think there's certainly some truth to those concerns, but I mean, practice may not make perfect, but it certainly doesn't hurt. And I think the trick here is I don't think we're at a point where we're really over-practicing. I think we're really in the initial stages of developing ways in which, after we devise these complicated, complex interagency plans, that we find a way to see, you know, whether they'll work in the real world. And so there's a whole systematic approach to testing these plans through tabletops and simulations and drills like this that needs to be institutionalized as part of our whole preparedness system. And I think this was just a real early effort, and it'll help shine some light on how we can do that more effectively.
Okay. I'm David Kestenbaum, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. John, I was wondering, when they say things happened at the, you know, at the airport and such, was there actually anything going on there, or that was just, you know, on the script, that was where things were supposed to start, and really you only saw things at the hospitals?
Well, no, there was a simulated plane accident at Midway Airport, and you know, it was kind of a made for TV kind of moment, which a lot of these things during the week were, two large kind of bonfires that were started, and the fire department had to put them out, and there were 100 some dead and 30 people critically injured that they had to transport, and they had all the ambulances at the airfield. So that was truly simulated. A lot of it was done on paper, and there were controllers who were kind of monitoring the game, at all of its phases. And the controllers, if the local officials weren't making decisions rapidly enough, would kind of push the game along. They'd say, okay, you actually have 500 dead now. Now you have to make a decision on this. What are you going to do? Because otherwise there was concern that, the game would drag on well past when it was supposed to. So the controllers kind of kept things moving along when they needed to be moved along. But, it was a mixture of on paper and in reality. But most of the stuff that the media got to see was kind of that made-for-television moments where there was, helicopters in the air and smoke and flames.
Right. You noticed on television that sort of shot up close, it looked impressive, and then occasionally you'd see a faraway shot and you realize the explosion was actually quite small.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Steve, from your Harvard Medical School, you're on the line. You have a question?
Yes. This is Dr. Stephen Locke. I'm a psychiatrist who's also the president of the American Psychosomatic Society, a research society that specializes in mind-body interaction. And at the society, quite a few of us have been concerned about the apparent lack of attention to a phenomenon that could seriously compromise our bioterrorism preparedness and response, and that is the probability, based on historical evidence from other episodes such as the sarin gas attack in Tokyo and the Scud missile attacks in Israel in 1991, that a preponderance of people appearing for medical care and seeking medical care will be people presenting with physical complaints that actually are experiencing body responses to anxiety or acute stress and are frightened and seeking urgent medical care, which in the face of a contagious agent could actually put people, were they to go to urgent care facilities, in contact with people who are actually contagious.
Okay, thanks very much. Dr. Ternan, can we get a quick answer to that?
Oh, I think that those are very important considerations in actual preparedness and response, and there's been a considerable amount of effort to try to upgrade both our public education and information efforts as well as our specific risk communication capabilities to address and hopefully to alleviate that problem.
Okay. We're running out of time, so I'd like to thank my guests, John McCormick, I just made you doctor there, general assignment reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and Dr. Bernard Ternock, clinical professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the director of the Illinois Public Health Preparedness Center. Thanks both for talking with us today. When we come back, we'll talk about a proposed journey to the center of the Earth. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm David Kestenbaum, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Now, an interesting paper is being published in the journal Nature this week. I'll just read you the title. A Modest Proposal, Mission to Earth's Core. Now, no one has ever broken through to the Earth's mantle, much less made it to the Earth's core. And this paper proposes to do that with a nuclear explosion, a lot of molten iron, and a grapefruit-sized communication probe. We didn't know quite seriously how to take this, so we called up the author. His name is David Stevenson. He's the George Van Osdell Professor of Planetary Science at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about our topic, check out our website. It's www.sciencefriday.com. Dr. Stevenson, just start by walking us through the steps. How would you get to the center of the Earth?
This mission is not to the center of the Earth. It's halfway to the center of the Earth, which is the top of the core. That's about 2,000 miles below Earth's surface. And you start by initiating a crack at the Earth's surface, perhaps explosively, perhaps not. You then pour into that crack a large amount of liquid iron. The weight of that liquid iron opens up the walls of the crack deeper down, and so the crack goes off driven by gravity. Earth does the work after you've got it started, and away it goes at 5 or so meters per second, the speed of a rapidly running person, and heads off to the core, taking about a week to get there. You insert in the liquid iron a solid probe that will measure things about the inside of the Earth and send that information back by acoustic waves.
And how much iron are you talking about here?
Talking about at least 100 million kilos. That happens to be about what you would get if you melted 10 Eiffel Towers. But you might need more than that.
Okay, and What's between? How's that work? Is it like a reverse volcanic eruption sort of?
It is indeed like a reverse volcano. The process that I'm describing is something that the Earth does every day. Many volcanoes rely on cracks that propagate upwards, and the difference there, of course, is that the liquid inside the crack is molten rock, which is less dense than the surrounding rock. In my case, I'm using molten iron, which is more dense, and so the crack goes in the opposite direction. But the physical process is essentially the same, and the crack that I want to use is smaller than what the Earth does every day.
All right, your paper's called A Modest Proposal, referring, I assume, to Jonathan Swift's 18th century solution to the problem of being too many poor kids. And Swift wrote, I have a little quote here, "I've been assured that a young, healthy child, well-nursed, is at a year old a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled." So his proposal was to eat the kids. Is your proposal in the same vein, or are you really quite serious about what you're proposing?
I have both the intent to entertain and the intent to make a serious point. I fully acknowledge that the likelihood that this can actually be done is fairly low, but certainly not zero. I want people to realize that this deserves serious attention. And I also want the scientific community to recognize that we have devoted less attention to questions such as this, because what has happened is that a very large amount of money has been spent on space exploration. And by the way, that's what I do. I am a planetary scientist, so I've benefited. We've spent in excess of $10 billion sending unmanned probes to other planets, going up, in other words. I think we should consider spending a comparable amount of money going down if it's possible.
Okay, let's take a call. Hey, Melissa from San Diego, you're on the line. Hello? Melissa? I guess we lost Melissa. I think her question was, why not put the probe in a volcano?
Yes, many people have asked that, and I would not exclude that possibility. It would certainly be preferable to a nuclear device. I worry that if you put it in a volcano, it would disperse. The plumbing of a volcano is complicated. You might lose the iron off in directions other than your intended direction. I want to have a clean crack, but I acknowledge that looking at the possibility of using a volcano is something we should do.
I mean, do you have to use a nuclear explosion? There is that test ban, you know, pesky thing.
Yes, there is that test ban.
I now regret
mentioning nuclear devices at all, because people react so strongly to that. Obviously, I want to do it without that. The main point I was making there is to get across an estimate of the amount of energy involved with the opening of the crack. It is substantial, however you do it. It's also true, however, that the Earth does this all the time, naturally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take another call. Fred from Syracuse.
Dr. Stevenson, it's Fred Jaquin. We met once when you interviewed me for graduate school at Caltech about 20 years ago. I'm a community college teacher now at Syracuse, New York, after finishing at Cornell. And I was talking with my colleagues about this project here, and we had two questions. One, how deep does the initial deposit of this iron have to be to prevent it from cooling too quickly? And could you tell us just a little bit about the cooling calculations? We couldn't imagine how this iron stayed molten all the way down.
Okay, give us a layman's version of those calculations, please.
Yes. Well, let me make it clear that the inside of the Earth is hot, and that an alloy, not pure iron, I mean, for simplicity, I've talked about it as pure iron, but it really isn't. There are alloys of iron that even in equilibrium will not freeze inside the Earth. It's true that the first 100 kilometers involves encountering colder material. And it's true
when you
that
say
you've
freeze,
got to get
you really
through
mean just
there.
Turn solid, right? When you
yeah.
say freeze, you just mean become like the iron we all think of, right?
Sorry?
When you say freeze, you just mean that it becomes solid iron, right? Like
that's
we're used
correct.
To thinking of. Yeah.
That's correct. It's just like freezing ice from water. It's the same physical
right.
process.
Right.
So you have to start out with a large reservoir of liquid iron, which I don't think is a fundamental difficulty. Think of it as a very large swimming pool with insulators around it. You then initiate a crack underneath it, perhaps, and the iron fills the crack. The length of the crack is like the height of the Empire State Building. It takes a time of minutes to hours to cause that material to solidify even when it is in a thin sheet. It doesn't start as a thin sheet, of course. But once it gets down more than a few tens of kilometers, it doesn't want to solidify at all. So it'll happily go for the rest of the week through the mantle. There may be some freezing. I'm not saying there's none.
Right.
But not so much solidification as to destroy the ability to keep moving.
Okay, great. Thanks, Fred. Let's take another call. Fred, Mitch. Sorry, Mitch from Berkeley.
Hi. The first thing I thought of was that there's I saw a billboard for a movie called The Core, where some kind of catastrophe requires that they, of course, send a team of heroes down to the Earth's core. And I just kind of wonder if it's an only coincidence that movie popped up and this proposal, or is this kind of life imitating art?
Yes, which way is it?
It is not a coincidence. the ideas for my paper were in my head 10 years ago, but when I was asked last October to make some comments about the upcoming movie The Core, it occurred to me at that point that this was the right time to put my ideas down in writing. So it was a trigger. However, there is no scientific connection between what's in the movie and what is in my paper.
Thanks, Mitch. Okay, I'm David Kestenbaum. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You know, I have another stumbling block for you here, which is, so how's it going to communicate back with the surface, this probe?
The probe will throb like a heart, and just as with a diaphragm and a loudspeaker, that will send out acoustic waves, which are indistinguishable from seismic waves. They're the same thing, and they will travel through the Earth just like the seismic waves from earthquakes, which, of course, can be seen right across the Earth.
Right,
every day of the week, seismic waves travel from one side of the Earth through the core and out the other side. This will be a very small wave, and so you need exquisite sensitivity.
I read in your paper that vibrations are less than the half the width of an atom's nucleus.
That's right.
things that are supposed to be able to measure that, but that's really hard, yes?
Oh, yeah, it's really tiny, but it's large compared to what LIGO is designed to measure.
LIGO is this big set
laser
of mirrors and lasers to measure vibrations. Yeah,
that's right. Well, of course, what it measures is vibrations of space-time. It doesn't measure actual
ground motions. Right, but it also measures lots of nasty things like noise they don't want to deal with, which you would be contributing to that noise and making their life a little harder, I imagine.
Yeah, well, seismic noise would be a problem for this mission, no doubt. So you have to send back a signal that's specially encoded so that you can handle a signal-to-noise less than one.
Does anybody call you up and say, no, you're wrong, this won't work? I mean, do you think it's possible there's something you haven't thought of?
I think that there are very major difficulties in making a probe that will measure something useful. I think the probability that all this will come to pass is, I don't know, in the few percent, certainly not 50-50 or anything like that. I really don't know. I mean, all I'm doing is trying to provoke people, provide a little bit of entertainment as well, but as with Jonathan Swift, there is a serious intent behind this, and maybe what will emerge from this eventually, with some low probability, is something along the lines that I had in mind, or maybe something else that also gets to the core.
Okay, let's take one more question. Lou Benday from Stockton, California.
Yeah, thank you very much. I assume the gentleman who is proposing this probe into the center of the Earth is educated enough to think of the consequences, if any. I'll take my answer off the air. My questions are, two of them, of course. Is there a natural occurrence that has happened already that is similar to opening up the Earth? And two, is there any risk that you are aware of? And what the effort?
Okay, good question.
If we mess the Earth, where are we going to go?
Okay, we got it.
Sorry.
Thanks very much. Can we get a quick answer to that?
Yes. The process that I want to use to get to the core is something the Earth does every day. There's absolutely no doubt about this. It's what volcanoes feed on. This is part of how many volcanoes work. So there's nothing unusual in that regard. What I want to do is smaller than what the Earth does as a natural process. Yes, of course, one should be concerned about environmental hazard. And it's possible that after working on this for a while, we will decide that the hazard is too great. It is too soon to say that with certainty. Therefore, we should look at the question. But I assure you that we as scientists don't want to do this if it really involves setting off a megaton nuclear device. Obviously, I'm hoping nothing like that is required.
Okay, thanks very much. We're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest this hour. David Stevenson is the George Van Osdell Professor of Planetary Science at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Earlier, we spoke with NPR's Richard Harris, John McCormick at the Chicago Tribune, and Dr. Bernard Turnock at the University of Illinois at Chicago. This program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer. Our intern is Adrian McDonald. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. For internet mail, you can email us at our address, which is scifry@npr.org. For NPR News in New York, I'm David Kestenbaum.